I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at KUCI.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at KUCI.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this July 31st, 2013 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI.org and also available via podcast. I'm your host, Nicole Nelson, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, Barbara DeMarco Barrett is here with authors, poets, literary agents, exploring the world of publishing. It is our pleasure today to be joined by two authors. In the second half hour, we will speak with debut novelist Jessica Lott. But first, we are joined by Susan Choi to talk about her new novel, My Education, published by Penguin. Susan Choi is the author of three previous books, The Foreign Student, American Woman, which was a finalist for the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, and her third, A Person of Interest, was a finalist for the 2009 Penn Faulkner Award. She's the recipient of many prestigious awards and fellowships, including one from the Guggenheim Foundation, and she teaches at Princeton. This is her first time on Writers on Writing, and we are delighted to have her. Susan Choi, welcome.
Thank you.
We find here that no one introduces a book better than the author, so could you tell us about your book?
Sure. I'll try not to give too much away. The protagonist of My Education is Regina. She's 21 years old. She is embarking on her graduate studies. She thinks that she wants to be an English professor, and she arrives on campus during a sort of a, you know, an Indian summer heat wave, and kind of immediately has her attention drawn by the worst possible person, and she kind of goes astray from there.
Great. And the whole story is narrated from Regina's point of view, and I'm always curious whether that was obvious to you, that the story should be told from her perspective, or how did you come across your point of view for this novel?
You know, it was always obvious to me that the story was going to be told from Regina's point of view, but what wasn't obvious to me was whether I would write the novel in first person, which is something I'd always wanted to do but had never succeeded in doing, or in the third person, which is the method that I've used for all three of my previous books. So I knew Regina was the storyteller, but I just wasn't sure if we were going to see it all through her eyes or if we were going to view her through a kind of a close, omniscient, third-person narrator. And I switched back and forth, actually, many times between first and third before I made up my mind.
How far did you get before you realized you wanted to experiment, switch around? Like, was that after an entire draft or a couple chapters?
It was after probably a couple of chapters. I feel like 70 or 80 pages I'd written in third-person, and then I just felt disappointed a little bit because I think first person as a writer has always fascinated me. You know, certain first person novels I think are so extraordinary in terms of what they accomplish with voice. And I just always wanted to do that, but always ended up feeling trapped. Mm-hmm. And with this book, when I realized how centered it would be on Regina for the first time, I thought maybe this is the book in which writing in the first person won't feel like confinement. Mm-hmm. So I tried it that way.
Right, and you mentioned that a couple of chapters, 70 or 80 pages, and I noticed that the chapters were long in this book. Is that just your style, or was there any, how did that, do you have any comments about the length of the chapters?
How did that happen? You know, I never write in chapters. I just sort of try to push the story forward when I'm writing a draft, and so I didn't, and I always have breaks, and I'm a big fan of the white space, to the point that I think I abused it a lot when I was a student writer. I had a professor once who said, the rigor of transitions, like implying that I wasn't willing to take on the rigor of transitions. I would just bail out and put in a white space and then start something new. So I always try to, do a transition when I can, but otherwise, you know, going along writing the story, when a white space really presents itself, I would put it there and then resume. And after I finished a draft, I went back and read the book, and certain of those white spaces to me clearly felt like chapter endings. I hadn't intended it when I was writing the draft, but once I was reading, it's easier sometimes when you're reading to, like, discern the book's rhythm. And when I was reading it, I thought, oh, this is a chapter. And then it would happen again sometime later. And I started putting in different kinds of breaks.
Yeah, and one thing that struck me about the end of the sections was you're really good at fade outs.
Oh, thanks. That sounds so cinematic.
maybe if you could read to us now.
Yeah, I was going to read a little bit from the beginning. I'm not going to read too much, but I'll just start on page one, read a few paragraphs. The heading is 1992. Since arriving the previous week, I'd kept hearing about a notorious person. And now, as I entered the packed lecture hall, my gaze caught on a highly conspicuous man. That's him, I declared inwardly, which of course was absurd. It was a vast university of thousands of souls. There was no reason these two kinds of prominence, scandalous noteworthiness and exceptional, even sinister attractiveness, must belong to the same human being. Yet they had. The man was Nicholas Brodeur, though I knew it for sure only later. That first time seeing him, even before being sure who he was, it was already clear that his attractiveness was mixed up with a great deal of ridiculousness. He wore a long duster coat in the heat of September. His filthy blonde hair stuck up and out in thatchy spikes from heavy use of some kind of pomade, as if it were 1982, not 92. And he wore linen shades with completely black lenses, as if it were outdoors, not in. And overall, in his resemblance to a Joy Division poster, he comported himself as if 20, and not, as I'd come to find out, almost 40. Still, he was the best-looking man by a league in the room, and certainly the best-looking man I had seen in the flesh to that point in my life. I hadn't yet lived in one of the world's great cities where such specimens congregate, but even now that I have, he still ranks. And he must have realized there was in his posture a kind of inverse vanity, a suggestion that he engaged in his sartorial ridiculousness out of some impatience with the effects of his beauty. He stood alone at the back, his feet away from the wall and his shoulders slumped against it. An ambiguous expression that was not quite a smile slightly lifted the sides of his mouth. His hands remained stuffed in the duster's deep pockets. The inappropriate hoodlum charade seemed to chide anybody who stared, as I did. I'd been inoculated against the villain Brodeur before I'd even enrolled. On my visit to campus the previous spring, my informational coffee with a second-year poetry student had been interrupted by a timorous, blushing undergraduate whom the second year had caught in a fervent embrace, then presented to me portentously as someone any woman considering coming here needs to talk to. In the course of preparing her senior thesis under Brodeur's direction, the undergraduate had been victimized by him. In what precise way it would victimize her further to ask her to relate. The result thus far had been a petition demanding his firing, but the second year was confident that far more severe retribution would follow. And I think I'll stop there for now.
Yeah, thank you. We're speaking with author Susan Choi. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And regarding Nicholas, have you gotten comments from readers that they knew Nicholas or that a Nicholas?
Everyone seems to either recognize him from their own experience or want to know if I borrowed him from my own experience. And I think he's a really familiar type, mm-hmm. Which was why I was eager to kind of play around with expectations, because he's set up as this very sinister sort of predator almost, and I don't think it's giving too much away to say that he doesn't really live up to his terrible reputation. He's not what he seems.
Right. And so we start off in 1992, as you said, and then there's a later section in the book, but as I was thinking back on it, one thing that struck me, I couldn't recall a single flashback. I mean, there was one, sort of one, but, and so it's so refreshingly linear. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Gosh, that's so nice that you said that. It's funny because now I'm kind of trying to think up flashbacks myself. I know that there've got to be some.
There's one, but it doesn't directly involve Martha. She's kind of giving backstory on Regina and Nicholas, but
right. You know, I'm glad it felt that way to you. I'm not sure if it's strictly the case that there are no flashbacks, but my first novel, which is called The Foreign Student, was really, really elliptical. It wasn't all flashback, but I had never written a novel before, and I didn't understand anything about how to handle structure, and so I didn't have a plan. But once I wrote a draft, it kind of became clear that a large chunk of that novel was taking place in the recent past of the character, and then another large chunk was taking place in the sort of present day of the character, and you just kept going back and forth and back and forth between the past and the present, in a way that I guess worked ultimately, but almost made me queasy, you know. And with my second book, I just thought, God, I really want to try to write something that actually moves forward in time, mm-hmm. at a steady beat, and I don't really know if I succeeded with that one, but I've been trying ever since. It's almost like my default to go backwards, even when I'm talking. You know, you just noticed, you asked me a question about this book, and I had to do a flashback to my first book to even answer you. So I'm constantly, in my writing, going into the past, and it's like I'm continually trying to correct that tendency. So I'm glad that you perceive the book as moving sort of steadily forward.
Definitely. I mean, I know that struggle, and so I did admire that.
Great.
We haven't talked about Regina yet, and she's the main character. And my first question for you about her is that there's this discussion going on in, you know, the literary world about likable narrators, and in particular how that pertains to female protagonists.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get any, like, feedback from your editors, or did you have any thoughts about, you know, Regina's likability level?
You know, I had a ton of thoughts about it before the book was published, and I believe, at least according to my standards, and I hope that she's quote-unquote likable, but I also find... Well, I have a couple things to say. First, just in terms of likability as a trait, the same question was raised in a reading that I did in Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago with Kathleen Shine, wonderful writer who has a book out right now called Finn and Lady, and I was really excited to share a stage with her. And someone asked this exact question with reference to my main character and hers. She also has a female main character in her book who's very unreliable, and does some things that are injurious to others. And so an audience member said, you know, what about likability? And I just want to quote Kathleen or paraphrase her, because she said something so smart. She said that she felt that often when readers felt that they, quote-unquote, didn't like a character, that they were actually using that word as shorthand for some other failing in the writing, like the writing failing to be engaging, failing to be compelling, failing to, you know, excite your empathy. It wasn't necessarily about whether the character was a good person or whether everything they did was really sort of laudable. And I thought that was so smart, because with Regina, initially, you know, likability was an issue in early drafts, but also I think there were other failings of the writing that I had to address, that, you know, when readers would read the draft, they would say, well, I'm just not sure I like her. And I would say, well, you know, that might be one thing, but I feel like, you know, that's shorthand for other things that are going wrong in the book, that the book is, you know, failing to make her bad decisions, which you wouldn't necessarily agree with or like, still the sorts of things that you could empathize with, that you could say, you know, I wouldn't do it, but, you know, I feel for her. I understand why she would, if that makes sense. I feel like likability has become like kind of this blanket term for all sorts of things that are more complicated or harder to talk about.
I mean, I do think you're right there, but I'm thinking of something that Curtis Sittenfeld said recently, and she talked about how, if, you know, a male protagonist can be like a serial killer, and, you know, if a mom who's the protagonist is late picking up her kids, then, you know, she's a bad person. And just that there seems to be a double standard in terms of judging them and when to play that, you know, bad person, you know, leading into likability. I don't know if you have any feelings about gender and that issue or not.
Yeah, I know. I've heard, I feel like there have been other comments recently, and you know, the question of whether a woman writer can get away with the same things that a male writer can get away with, and also whether a female character can get away with the same things a male character can get away with. I find it really hard to sign on to the idea that male characters can do things and retain the sympathy of the reader that female characters can't do. Mm-hmm. I'm just not sure if I believe that. I do think, you know, that gender plays a huge role in how we perceive characters, but I still think that the writing is what's going to decide it ultimately. And I think that you could have a female character doing extraordinarily unlikable things, and I think that if she was written well, written right, you know, I think that she is going to engage, you know, the empathy, the understanding, the investment of the reader as much as a male character would. I mean, I recently read a book, a very, very sort of globally popular book right now, in which I found both the male character and the female character horribly unlikable. And I've been thinking about this whole question of character likability, and I was thinking, like, well, what's going on here? Do I not enjoy this book because I don't want to have dinner with these people? Or do I not enjoy this book because I feel like the author has somehow failed to make the horribleness of the characters fascinating and human to me? And I really felt like it was the latter, you know? I mean, Lolita is possibly my favorite novel. I'm never going to say that I think that Humbert is a, you know, well-adjusted person that I would want to be married to, but I think that it's a brilliant novel because, despite the fact that he's a pedophile, we feel so deeply for him, you know? And I think that's the accomplishment that novels can aim for. So I just don't know if it's really about, like, the gender of a character so much as did the author pull it off, you know?
Right.
Did they make that character someone who is compelling to you despite, you know, possibly despite their terrible crimes?
No, that's well put. We're speaking here with author Susan Choi. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And Susan, a couple of your other books required heavy research. And this book, you know, how did it compare?
I was so eager to write a book that didn't require heavy research. And I love that you asked that question. It's almost as if I feel like I asked you to ask that question because before I knew anything about this book, before I knew who the characters were or what the story was, I knew that it was a book that I wasn't going to research. I was really unable, actually, to do heavy research the way I'd done with my first three books. I had a new baby. I was so tired, and I just wanted to write something without getting all obsessive about some obscure subject, which is something I'd really enjoyed doing with the previous three books, but I just didn't have it in me this time around. And you know, I knew in my gut it was going to be a book about people and relationships, and that was it. And I almost felt apologetic initially. You know, people would ask me what I was working on, and I kept saying, oh, you know, I'm just trying to write this little book about people and relationships. And finally, I stopped saying that because it sounded so kind of condescending, because I was like, you know, some of the greatest books I've ever read are actually about people and relationships. I don't need to apologize. But yeah, not doing research was my main aim.
And do you outline your books?
I don't outline my books before I've written them, but with this book, for the first time, I kind of outlined it after I drafted it, which was a method that I learned from Jennifer Egan. Actually, she gave an interview in a book that I teach from, in which she talked about outlining after the fact just to make a map of what she'd done in a draft in order to try to make a plan for how to revise. And I was so impressed with how smart that is and how logical it is with fiction, because using outlines to create fiction has never made sense to me. It's never worked for me personally. But always after kind of creating a draft out of, like, gut instinct and stumbling around in the dark and just kind of, you know, letting the writing kind of lead me wherever it wanted to go, I would end up being totally baffled by the job of revision. And so making this outline of my draft after I'd drafted it and just sort of looking at it to understand, like, what the draft actually consisted of was really helpful. This was the first time I ever did that.
That is so interesting, because I haven't heard much about that, but then just recently on the show, Karen Joy Fowler talked about having a very similar process of outlining afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, I wish someone had told me this earlier, honestly. It just goes to my feeling that, you know, however much I love teaching writing and however much I loved being a student writer, it's just impossible to teach. You just kind of learn it by trial and error. I mean, that thing, when I stumbled across that in the interview with Jennifer Egan, I, like, ran to my students. I was like, this is so smart. I never thought of this before. I've written three books.
In your teaching, I noticed that you taught a course with the, you know, possible aim of completing a novel in 60 days. So that seems to tacitly endorse speed in writing. Do you have any comments about writing with velocity?
Yeah, writing with velocity. That course was so much fun. The course had a long subtitle, which I think was, or short. The course was called How to Write a Novel in 12 Weeks, and I think the subtitle was Or Die Trying. And then I felt like that was kind of a dire thing to say in a course catalog, so I changed it to Or Make a Valiant Effort. The main aim of that course was just to give longer form fiction a chance in the context of the program that I teach in at Princeton. Because it's so hard to teach longer form fiction in a workshop situation, because you have students coming in every week trying to share things. We're only together for 12 weeks total at a time. So everything about that is biased towards short fiction, but so many of my students were really interested in writing long fiction, and that's what I do. And so, you know, we sat around going, like, could we do something that would let us play around with long fiction? And the idea that anybody would finish an entire draft in that period of time was kind of a joke. But as I said to my students the first day, I was like, this is a joke, but it's a serious joke. We're not going to expect that we'll do this, but we're actually going to try. Like, why not? Why not try and see how far you can get? And it always was meant to be a draft. I was like a messy, dirty, crazy draft. You don't have to share it with anyone, although I wanted them to share it. But the idea was just to achieve velocity, really, like you said. And that was done by, I made them all sort of sign a pact that they would write every weekday. They had a minimum word count. They had to file their word count with me via Gmail every day. And I was like, if you actually do that, you won't have a finished novel at the end of these 12 weeks, but you'll have a huge chunk of writing, like 60 to 75 pages. And it was amazing for everyone. Everybody, all my students were sort of blown away by how much they were able to do in that amount of time. You know, you can't write a whole book, but you can do so much more than you might think.
Yeah, I was struck. There were comments from one of your students online about that, and she talked about pushing through the days when she didn't feel like writing 300 words and just the discipline that it gave her to just kind of have that obligation and to do it anyway, and that it was a breakthrough for her.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. I think it was a breakthrough for me when I realized that writing every day was something that my writing was going to benefit from, even if any particular day's writing stank. You know, just engaging with it every day, making that part of your brain work on that particular project, that's where the progress comes from, you know? And I'll tell them, like, you may generate piles of pages that are destined for the garbage, but in the process of doing that, you're actually getting to the better writing, and you're never maybe going to get there without, you know, generating that other stuff, because it's very, at least for me, writing is very process-based. I solve a lot of problems while I'm doing it. I don't solve them just sort of sitting around thinking.
Right. And so you leave, it sounds like you leave a fair amount to the revising phase. So I was wondering what you have to say about revising, and also at what point do you seek feedback?
I seek feedback. I mean, I'm always so anxious for feedback. I can't really function without it. I usually try to wait until I have a substantial enough chunk of something that I kind of know where it's going, and the feedback won't throw me for such a loop that I can't continue on. In the case of this book, I think, you know, when we were talking about point of view, this first 70-odd pages were probably the first set of pages that I also showed my really trusted readers and said, you know, what do you think? And in fact, at that time, I had a couple of different readers weighing in on the first person versus third person. So usually when there's a big chunk and then another big chunk and maybe the first draft, I'll try to find readers, usually the same people, mm-hmm. who will tell me the truth. Revising is really hard, and I couldn't do it without those readers.
Yeah. Well, Susan, we're drawing down on our time here, but in the minute or so left, is there any writing advice that you can offer our listeners?
I feel like we've hit on my best piece of writing advice, which is always, if you can write every day, even if it's just for 15 minutes, try to do it. I constantly ignore this advice of my own, but it makes such a difference. I mean, even if you can, like, sit down at your desk and write a paragraph or even a few sentences, I just feel like keeping that part of your mind working on it with consistency is so much more fruitful than, you know, carving out, like, a week or even one day a week or, you know what I mean, just a little at a time. That's always, in the end, been the way I got anything done.
Well, thank you so much, Susan. And that was, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Great. That was author Susan Choi talking about her latest book, My Education, published by Penguin. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with us. Coming up next is debut novelist Jessica Lott, who will discuss her book, The Rest of Us. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. We gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I'm your guest host, Nicole Nelson, and I'm joined now by debut novelist Jessica Lott. Jessica Lott's novella, Osen, won the Novella Award from Low Fidelity Press. In addition to Osen, she has published short fiction, essays, and art reviews, appearing in, among other places, The New York Times and The Modern Spectator. Jessica Lott's debut novel is called The Rest of Us. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it is my pleasure to welcome her to the show. Jessica, hello and welcome.
Hi, Nicole. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, we're glad to have you. And to start out, could you introduce the book for us and tell us what it's about?
I always describe it differently, I think, than it's been described. But it is sort of a May-December love story between two people, an older poet and a younger photographer. And their relationship started when she was in college, and she was his student. And where the book begins is it begins where they meet up again after not having seen each other for about 15 years.
Great. And the story, and I guess I'll just acknowledge that there are some very superficial similarities between your book and the one we just talked about, My Education by Susan Choi. But your story is narrated by Terry in the first person. And I wondered here about point of view again. When you were writing the book, did you settle quickly on that point of view, or did you try out different options?
It was such a struggle, I have to say. You know, it was, I had never written a first-person female before. Mm-hmm. All through grad school, I'm very comfortable with close third-person male voice. And that's what Osen, my previous novella, was in, and that's what all my short stories were in, and it's just the voice that feels like my voice, you know. And so I tried to, when I discovered that the novel was becoming a novel, I tried to do that again, and I tried to go and have it narrated from Reinhardt's perspective. And it just wasn't working, and I didn't know why it wasn't working, and it was excruciating. I mean, I was trying to make this thing work that wasn't, and I understood then that I needed to do it from Terry's view, and I needed to do first-person female, and when I made that decision, it was so difficult. I mean, you would think it would be easier, but for me, I really struggled with this idea of what is serious literature, and I think that I had a lot of hang-ups as to literature that was written from women. I mean, it was all these things came up at the time that I was writing it. So I'm really grateful for that experience because I understood that the book needed to come from Terry, and I needed to change my view on how I read as a reader and a writer.
That's interesting. And I saw one blurb that talked about how it positively said that the book read like a memoir. And I know what that person said, but I wondered if that had something to do, you know, with it being from a female first-person perspective. And I was wondering what your reaction was to that. Like, did it raise any hackles? Or?
Well, it's funny because I was so flattered by that in some ways because it means that there's some truth to it, that it could feel... I mean, I don't like writing personal memoir pieces. I'm starting to a little bit now, but they make me so uncomfortable. I feel so exposed, and I feel so my voice in that first person, that I, feels awkward to me when I'm writing about myself. And so that's why fiction was always comfortable, because in fiction I could get at something that was felt like truth, an emotional truth that I couldn't capture when I was talking about myself, because I was too self-conscious. So I was pleased to hear that. I think that there probably is, people think, because the narrator were roughly the same age and female, and the artistic angle too, and me being a writer, that there's some overlap there. but I'm hoping that it may, I don't know, that there's some truth in the book. I was curious about that when I heard that response. It feels like fiction to me. It doesn't feel like at all like my life. You know, I went for this big separation between the book and Jessica, you know, so.
Right. Well, just what you were saying about your ideas coming to it as a woman, and just that same reviewer or blurber might not have said that if it had ended up being in Reinhardt's perspective. But I don't know. Now would be a good time for you to read to us, if you would.
Sure. All right. I'm going to read from the beginning.
Okay.
And this scene actually takes place in the past. It was the beginning of November. Exactly 15 years ago, I'd been 19, and in my junior year of college in upstate New York, I drove a rattling Nissan and wore the same pair of maroon corduroys every day. They were split in the left knee, and in the cold, the wind would come in and deaden the skin. I sort of liked the sensation, but Reinhardt feared frostbite and bought me thermals that I refused to wear, and a green beret they styled perched on the back of my head. I pulled it down so that it covered my ears. My ears were a source of embarrassment to me, the way the tips protruded from between the strands of hair, which was a nice brown and long, but too straight. I mostly wore it up with bobby pins that dislodged and were scattered around the house, he said, like feathers from a rare bird that let me know where you've been. You keep it too neat here, I said, otherwise you wouldn't notice. Except when he was writing, the only mess was stacks of newspapers and journals, the occasional used coffee cup, or jelly jar stained red in the bottom from wine, the living room of the house he rented for the duration of his time as a visiting writer at my college. This was what he had chosen, an old house with creaking doors and a bathroom under the staircase. He brought some of his furniture, an enormous feather bed that he dragged his library into. He was working on the collection of poetry that would win him the Pulitzer, through miserable fits of self-doubt and manic intensity that made life even more exciting for me than it already was. I met him at an artist lecture in town that summer, 2 months before he'd begun his appointment at the school. We'd started talking about our mothers, both of whom had died when we were young. Slightly embarrassed, he'd revealed that he just attended a seance in Manhattan and described the cramped, overheated room into which his mother didn't appear. I reached into my pocket and showed him pebbles that my mother had collected from the beach near our house. It was bizarre and superstitious, but sometimes, if I was nervous, I'd carry them around knowing she had once touched them. She died when I was 3. Unlike other people, Reinhardt didn't assume that because I couldn't remember her, I didn't miss her. Afterwards, I knew he was someone I wanted to be around. If I hadn't been in the grip of some sort of magical thinking, I would have recognized that he was in his 40s, nearing the height of his career, and a professor. I would have been intimidated, rightly. I would never have had the guts to pursue him. I told myself, I'll just try and get to know him better. But it wasn't as easy as all that. It took me weeks to distinguish myself from the other young people milling around town that summer. We did become friends, but by then I felt we should be together and said so. He had discovered that I was a college student and was reluctant. I plowed ahead, too confident in the connection between us to be dissuaded, and in the end I was right. Once he'd overcome his own objections, we'd move very quickly from dating to falling in love to being in a relationship. He was continually amazed by how visual I was. I was a photographer, or an aspiring one. That fall, I was often at his house shooting. The slim white birches just beyond the porch, sun on the floor, Reinhardt's fingers gripping a pen, the blonde stubble on his face. I had almost too many ideas. In the morning, I disappear on my bike and to take pictures in the woods, returning to a large, silent afternoon indoors, steam hissing up from the radiators. We'd sit on opposite ends of the couch, Reinhardt crossing out lines in a yellow memo pad, while I sketched future projects, and the fickle sun moved back and forth in the doorway. Occasionally, when he wasn't looking, I'd watch him. I'd been excruciatingly happy. For months, I walked around with a foolish smile on my face. Everywhere, even in the bathroom.
Great. Thank you. That was Jessica Lott, reading from her new novel, The Rest of Us, published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And Jessica, hearing that you toyed with this point of view going between Reinhardt and Terry, did those point of view flips in your mind or when you were switching them, did that affect the story? Because I realize that it very much is their story, and maybe it didn't change much. But
yeah, it took, well, I mean, I have to say, too, that from the time I began the novel to now is close to 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started, I had just graduated from Boston University's creative writing program. And so I was just doing some writing. I was just sort of messing around. I wasn't sure where it was going. And once it started to develop into something, I think over that time, I mean, I lived so much of my life, my 30s, actually, were lived while writing this book. And I moved to New York, and I was working in the arts and an art museum. And all of that kind of life was also sort of infused in the book and into the perspective of these two people and also the dynamic between them. I think that I had probably a lot to learn about relationships, too. And so in that sense, their relationship did shift along with my own understanding of relationships.
Mm-hmm. And, excuse me, you mentioned moving to New York, and there are many rich details here about the New York art world and technical aspects of high-end cameras and lighting and film developing. Mm-hmm. And so I was curious what kind of research you did. It sounds like, well, why don't you tell us?
Well, I worked at the time as an editor, and I still am an editor, and I'm also an art critic, as you had mentioned earlier. So I had a lot of knowledge about art. I've always had such a strong interest in it. I mean, I think that that's where it comes from originally. I think I'm sort of a failed artist in some ways. I was a sculptor in college, and then I just sort of transitioned into writing. But I have such a passion for visual arts, and so I'm continually drawn to it. And in terms of the photography, I think that's also, you know, my brother's a fashion photographer, and so I consulted with him on a lot of these facts mm-hmm. and things. But I think that it's a process of osmosis. A lot of times you're absorbing stuff that you're around, but also that you're interested in because either other people are participating in it or people that you know well. So all of that kind of comes together in the book, and that's a sort of the fictional world emerges from that, from all those bits of truth. So the research part, I absolutely love researching, and I read a lot. I mean, I read continuously, and I read really esoteric stuff. I think the best is sometimes I get ideas from sort of random books that I find in, you know, flea markets and things. So I think that that makes for a richer end product, is all of that, is taking all those bits and pieces.
So
the research is very important, and I love it. It's my favorite part, actually.
And it's so striking at first when you come across an author who has such a deep experience in the visual arts, because it seems different, but I know it's certainly not unprecedented. I guess Andrew Weiner, is that his name, was also an art critic. Okay. About titles. So your title is The Rest of Us, and titles can be hard. How did you find your title for this book?
Oh, the title was a huge... Huge struggle. It was probably, I feel like the editing was easier than the title. We went back and forth because the title of the book originally was called Reinhardt's Resurrection. And it was too strange and old-fashioned, I think, when the book sold. My editor at the time, Anjali Singh, who was wonderful, wonderful editor, said, look, we need something that's going to have more of an appeal, and that will open up the book more to readers. And so we went back and forth. I mean, generated so many titles. I thought I was going to go insane. It was just, it was a really hard process. And finally, we had had two, there's a book of poetry by Carl Phillips, which I just am in love with. It's called The Rest of Love. There was another title that was on the table called Us Again, which I wasn't as keen on, and I think that that had some support in the publishing. And so when I got together with my editor, we were just having lunch. We had lunch in Greenwich Village. I remember this day. It was kind of exciting to hit on the title, and we put the two of them together, The Rest of Us, and both of us had this moment where it clicked. And we're like, wow, because it says, it felt like it was this multivalent title where it kind of suggests several things. It suggests the rest of a relationship, as something unfinished but yet something open-ended. The rest of us, in terms of people who are trying to live. So much of the book is about Terry's own artistic growth and process. So it's also people who are living a life unlike other people. They're struggling to sort of make their own way. So I really like that about the title, that it suggested so many different things inside the book and seemed sort of open. So finally we hit on something, but I mean, there was a period of time there where I didn't think it was going to happen. We'd go out there without a title or something. It just didn't seem like we were making progress. It's very hard. It's very hard to get a title.
You've written a novella and short stories, and I was curious when I read that in your bio about the novella, because you don't hear that often. Was there external pressure with that to make it longer, or to make it more commercially viable? Or,
well, the novella was the novella I wrote for school at BU, and It was part of my thesis, and I was studying under Hajian, who's just he's very well known as a writer, but he's also an incredibly kind and insightful person. He's a mentor, and so he really, working with him on that particular novella, I was able to explore a longer form piece. And I'm sort of a longer form writer. Short stories don't come that easily to me. I much prefer a novel, which it's like this big suitcase I can like dump a lot of stuff into and sort through it. Short stories are hard for me, and so the novella was kind of fun because it was a way to kind of experiment with a longer form piece, but still have it be manageable and not so unwieldy. And so I finished it, and then I put it away, and then there was, I was constantly scanning, the back of Poets and Writers magazines where they list all of the competitions and everything like that. And there was a novella competition, and so I sent it in. It was being judged by Amy Bender, so that was sort of attractive to me, and I sent it in, and it won. And so it was sort of, at this joyous moment, my first publication, and the spoils was publication. So it was really great because I learned so much about, it was a smaller press and very hands-on, and I got to have a very hands-on role with the cover, with everything else. So I sort of learned how to do things, which is really important to know how to do things first, because when you sign on with a bigger publisher, you're dealing with people who are just, who are so good. I mean, they're sort of at the top of their game, all of them, and your role, consequently, is a little bit smaller. So it's good to know how to put a book together on your own. And so that was a lot of fun. And Ozen was, we had a party and everybody, came and, people bought it. But it was I understood it to be a smaller book and a smaller distribution. And I love Ozen, but it's very different. It was my first, my first attempt at a book, so... Yeah, I'm happy for it that it's out there.
We're speaking with author Jessica Lott. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And I must say, those sound like really, really good odds. I mean, one contest, one win, that's impressive. With the book, can you tell us how you brought it from completed draft to published novel? Was it one query letter? Or?
I spent a long time. I mean, I push this a lot because I think that even like culture, we concentrate on success, and there is so much rejection. I mean, I was rejected. Well, I've been rejected like you wouldn't believe. Everybody, I think every writer has. You submit to hundreds of things and maybe one gets in, but all you need sometimes is one. And I think that it teaches you perseverance and to be kind of tough. And when I started the novel, I mean, I was struggling on so many different levels. I was struggling to understand how to do it, how to write a full-length work, and I was also struggling to how to have a life and also write, and I hadn't quite developed very good writing habits in terms of writing every day and that sort of thing. So it was constantly with me, and I was working on it. But, you know, years passed, and New York is an incredibly entertaining place to live, and there's always something to do, you know, and I was working full-time at the Brooklyn Museum, and all of that was great because I was absorbing a lot of knowledge, so it makes for a better final product, but it also was a struggle. I actually had to leave. I had maybe, I don't know, 400 pages or something without, you know, it was like I had written the same scene three or four different times. So that was part of the 400 pages, but it was missing like a really crucial transition that the book needed. I don't write front to back. I write the scenes, and then I kind of knit them all together and sort of sculpt them on a later stage because I like them to feel fresh and very dynamic, like they do when I'm writing by hand. So I had this monster, and I realized I just couldn't stay. I had to leave New York. So if I was going to have any hope of finishing it, so I left. I left my job, left my apartment, and went to Spain for 3 months. And I did two writing residencies there. And in the second writing residency, I still felt like I was going to finish. It was hard. It was overwhelming, and I didn't know how I was going to do it. And in the second residency, Fundación Valparaíso, which I don't know if they're still open, but it was just wonderful. It was this quiet space. I've been traveling around Spain for months by myself, just sort of backpacking around. And I settled in, and I sat down with this book, and I just methodically went through it and made up a chart or like a timeline thing, and I went chapter by chapter by chapter and pulled it together. And it was, I'm so thankful for that experience. I had a very, very quiet, they took care of everything, and I made it work. And then so when I returned to New York, I had pretty much a finished product and was able to then shop it around for an agent. It definitely happened in stages, and I feel, looking back, so incredibly fortunate because I needed, you know, incredibly fortunate for that residency that I was able to get into and to be able to finish, because that was the hardest part, is finishing it.
Yeah, it's great, and it's interesting that you were able to, you know, listen to your own need to have that to finish, and it came
I got really miserable. I mean, I think that there's like nothing that spurs you on. It's like an intense depression. You know, at one point I was at New York, in New York, and I was like, I can't. I have to. I'm so unhappy right now. I have to finish this thing. And that, surprisingly, it was from that low place that I was able to find the energy to complete the book, because I had been ignoring it for too long, and I had a low-grade depression because I wasn't writing, and I really felt I needed to. So once I connected with that, new challenges appeared, but I was able to do the thing I really deeply wanted to be doing, and there's a sense of satisfaction from that. And I'm just not as unhappy. You know, it feels like I'm doing the right thing.
And, Jessica Lott, we're drawing down on our time, but I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on social media for authors. So how about Twitter and Facebook? Are they valuable or time sucks or something?
They're incredibly valuable. You know, I was just talking about this last night with a friend of mine who owns a bookstore, and we were talking about it, and the challenge it is for authors to do this now. My challenge is... There's an art to it. I mean, to have it in social media, to have a voice so that you're kind of giving exposure to your work, but you're not beating people over the head with it, so that it's not obnoxious, but it's sort of, you're putting it out there. And that's sort of a delicate balance that I've been playing with. I feel I've been experimenting with the social media. I mean, it definitely is a huge advantage in the promotional stage of things. And the internet in general, I mean, to write a book, the internet now is fantastic because you can research so easily. So there's definitely advantages to it, but I think it is really tricky. I mean, you have to really, there has to be a time where you cut yourself off from it so you're not constantly being marshaled around by this, you know, your electronic device.
Oh. Right. Well, Jessica, I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us here on Writers
on Radio.
That was Jessica Lott, author of The Rest of Us, published by Simon & Schuster, out and available in bookstores now. That's all the time we have for today. Barbara DeMarco Barrett will be here next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. with more authors and publishing professionals. Thanks today to Marie Stone for helping with engineering. And stay tuned for Roots and Rhythms coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.